From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Good afternoon and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up on this Thursday edition, just when you thought the political divide in America could not be worse, Nancy Pelosi has taken the unprecedented steps of announcing an impeachment investigation of President Trump without a vote of the House of Representatives.
I'm announcing the House of Representatives moving forward with an official impeachment inquiry. I'm directing our six committees to proceed with their investigations under that umbrella.
House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy introduced a resolution yesterday disapproving of the Speaker's actions. The measure was tabled by the House Democrats. Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy joins us in just a moment. And what is the impeachment process? What are the steps? How long will this process take? I mean, how long do we have to put up with this political circus? Well, we're going to talk about that as well a little bit later. Also, after driving ISIS from Iraq, why are Christians, Yazidis, and other religious minorities not returning to their communities in Iraq? That was the focus of a hearing on Capitol Hill this afternoon that I chaired in my role as chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. One of my fellow commissioners who was recently in Iraq, Nadine Meanza, joins us for that conversation. And speaking of religious freedom, the so-called fact checkers are challenging President Trump's statement that he made Monday at the United Nations that 80% of the world's population is suffering from some form of religious oppression or persecution. Travis Weber here at the Family Research Council joins me for that discussion. And I'll have a little bit more insight from my trip yesterday to the border in El Paso. It was a very enlightening trip. Even I was surprised at how the media was able to twist what has taken place there at the border. So all of that and more coming up on this edition of Washington Watch. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you are on Twitter, it is at T. Perkins. All right. Yesterday, a resolution disapproving of the unilateral steps taken by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was introduced by House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy from California. He introduced this measure, really kind of exposing the unprecedented steps that were being taken by this speaker to try to bring down this president, stop his advancement of the policies that he was elected to enact. And the resolution was tabled along party lines. Joining me now to talk about it is the minority leader in the House of Representatives, Kevin McCarthy. Kevin, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you so much, Tony. I appreciate all the work you do.
Well, thank you.
Out and about.
Well, this is, to me, one of the most unbelievable aspects of this. And you brought this to the forefront yesterday with your resolution. That never, ever in the history of the House of Representatives of the federal government has a president been an impeachment investigation of a president begun without a vote of the House of Representatives.
Now, if you just look at modern history, we've impeached three times here, two judges and then President Clinton. And every time the committee even wrote when they put the House resolution that this is of such great importance, and the Constitution says it's all with the House, starting it, that they needed direction and from the full body. Now, if you watched what Speaker Pelosi said, she went there and said, we're going to have an impeachment inquiry, never before, without having a vote of the floor, because she wants it two ways. When she said that, that made no difference whatsoever. Nothing changed when she said that. But what's the real challenge here is she is the Speaker of the House, but she's not the voice of America. The voice of the constituents across this country, and they lend their power to their representative and their voice for every 2 years. She just took that all away. There should be a vote on the floor, and what she wants to do is she's trying to protect her members not to have to vote on this.
Yeah, I think that's what it – I mean, she has the votes. If she wanted to – I mean, the Democrats are in the majority.
She would, yes.
But she does not want them to be on record because this, like the other investigations, Russia, collusion, all of that, when it comes out that there's nothing here, they're going to have to answer for that when they go back and face their constituents.
Remember, AOC tweeted against the speaker over the weekend, and then she came out and she had that press conference saying there's going to be impeachment inquiry before one bit of evidence was presented.
Right.
She never even read anything yet, and then she claimed in that press conference that the president violated the law.
Now, the president has released the transcript, the full transcript of the conversation. He is providing all of the information. I mean, the transparency that he is providing here, nothing like I saw in the previous administration. What's the way forward here? What do you think is going to be the ultimate outcome? How long is this going to take? And is this simply more of the same to try to derail this president's agenda?
Well, it goes to show, even if you watch the Intel committee today, the chairman, Schiff, he starts it off with a parody. It just shows how unserious they are about something that is so serious about an impeachment of a president. It also goes to show that they don't care about facts. They just want to base it on politics of where they want to try to move forward. They were unsuccessful with the Mueller. They were unsuccessful today. The president had to just release his phone conversation with another world leader.
Mm-hmm.
That has just weakened every president in the future. Who's going to have a conversation? And an honest one,
right,
with the president. They're afraid their conversation is going to get leaked.
Very, very, very good point. And but this also, the intelligence community, what role are they playing in this?
Well, that is a concern to us. We saw before that this whistleblower, he or she, wasn't on the phone call. Everything they allege is they heard from somebody else. But now we have the facts. We have the transcript. There is nothing in that transcript that is impeachable. They tried to say prior to the transcript that the president offered some quid pro quo. We find that not to be true. The president talked about the investigation because of the corruption of what transpired in 2016. Nothing about an election in the future. And that is all legal in an open investigation being driven by the attorney general.
Kevin, my deeper concern here, and I even had these concerns during the Obama administration, is once you go to a certain length, and what we're seeing here of this president, you talked about, I mean, this is just one example of many where this president, in this case, having a conversation with a world leader, this, you know, now being, you know, having to release an entire transcript, you know, what world leaders are going to be hesitant to talk to the president next. We've seen him have private meetings in the White House in which information was leaked with other world leaders. So, I mean, this does damage to our system of government that, quite frankly, may never be fixed.
So true. And the question here is they're breaking the fiber of this nation. Think about how
right.
serious this is, Tony. They're questioning impeaching the leader of the free world. And they take it so lightly. But it's in the Constitution about what rises to a crime in others. Nothing here does that. But when they told the American public to trust them that they would be different if they got the majority, they lied to them.
Yeah.
The head of the judiciary, Congressman Nadler, he actually campaigned when they won the majority that he would be the best chairman for impeachment. That's what they voted on based on where they wanted to put him. This has all been about politics. This is still about the 2016 election, but it's not based on facts. And I'm sorry, this country is too great to have such a small vision of just impeachment and investigation.
You know, my take on this is I've been monitoring. I was out, as I mentioned at the top of the program, I was in Texas yesterday in El Paso at the border and was in New York on Monday for the UN speech the president made. So I've been kind of traveling all this week. Most of America has almost grown immune to the political noise that Nancy Pelosi and their party made. It's just like this president, no matter what he does, where he goes, what he says, they attack it. And I'm not sure that they're going to be able to politically break through on this, that people have just kind of become inoculated to the just everything that they keep doing.
It is exactly what they've been trying to do. But we have so many big problems. We have a border that you were just down that we need to secure and solve an immigration problem. We have the United States, Mexico, and Canada trade agreement that Mexico has already ratified. Canada is only waiting on us. It guarantees at the very minimum to bring 160,000 jobs, makes America stronger, especially in our debate with China. Mexico and Canada have now surpassed China as our top traders. But that's not coming forward. We have a surprise billing where people go to a hospital within their own network, and they get a big price that they never should. But that's not moving. There are so many problems out there that we could be solving. But the Democrats are so focused on one thing, their hatred of the president, lawlessness of where they want to go, and they just want to impeach him.
It is disturbing. And going back to the earlier point, I think that this does great damage to our system of government. And oftentimes when we set these new standards, we break precedent, we go places we've not been before, it's hard to recover.
It is. It does damage to the country. It affects everything about it. And I just ask that the Democrats put the country before their politics. That's all that would be important.
Final question. I know you got to go, Kevin, but do you think that Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats in this latest move are overplaying their hand?
By far. For the Speaker of the House, third in line for the President of the United States, for her to claim impeachment inquiry without one bit of evidence, not even waiting for it. There's people in her own conference, Democrats, questioning why did she move so soon. And she put the entire Democrats in a really bad position to be in.
Well, for the sake of the country, I hope we move through this quickly, resolve it, and allow this administration to move forward with what I have seen for the last 2.5 years is exactly what he promised the people when they voted for him and elected him in 2016.
Well, thank you so much for all your hard work.
All right, Kevin McCarthy, thanks so much for joining us, and obviously we'll be watching this as it unfolds.
Okay, take care.
All right, that was House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy of California talking about the resolution he introduced yesterday to disapprove of the steps taken by Nancy Pelosi that was rejected. Now, folks, let me just say what this is all about, okay? This president has been opposed at every turn. And I think it's because the left is not accustomed to someone actually – they're accustomed to people making Republicans making political promises, but they're not accustomed to someone systematically following through. This is about the president's policies. Let me just take what happened this week that I saw with my own eyes in New York, the United Nations, first president to take a challenge to the international community to protect religious freedom, houses of worship. And at the same time, his administration, Secretary Pompeo, Secretary Azar, challenging countries involved in the United Nations to protect life and the family. And then yesterday at the border, which I'll talk about later. This is the first president that is actually doing what he said he was going to do. And they don't like his policies. And they can't argue successfully against those policies, so they have to go after the president. That's how I see it. All right, don't go away. When we come back, we're going to take a deeper look at the issue of impeachment. How is this going? How does this work? What's the process? What's the time frame? What can we expect? That's next. Don't go away. More Washington Watch to come.
We live in a time of great political division, and this division only intensifies during campaign season. The toxic tone in politics can be discouraging, which makes it a very real temptation for many Christians to wipe their hands of politics altogether. After all, if God is sovereign and controls the heart of the king, as Proverbs says, do we really need to get involved in the messy world of politics? Because political engagement can be divisive, shouldn't Christians abandon politics and direct their energies toward more spiritual pursuits? Christians are called to submit every area of their life to God, which includes how they engage in politics. But they are called to engage biblically. This requires Christians to be prepared to follow their political theology to its logical end and vote for candidates and parties that support clear biblical values. For more information on the Christians' call to engage in politics, visit frc.org/engage. That's frc.org/engage.
News. We can get it from many sources, but what can you trust these days?
Where can you get news that doesn't make you as suspicious as you are informed? If you're looking for something better, for honest coverage of the latest news, one trusted news source I look to is the Washington Times. When preparing for the radio program and selecting guests to join me on the show, I will often read the Washington Times and have their reporters join me here on the program because I trust how they cover the news. Join me and more than 7 million readers who turn to the Washington Times every month to get real, trusted news. For a limited time only, listeners of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins will receive a special annual rate of $69.95 for the first year. Subscribe to the Washington Times and get this special offer by using my name and visiting washingtontimes.com/Tony Perkins. That's washingtontimes.com/Tony Perkins.
Are you a student? Do you know a student? Well, this year, students can apply for scholarships to attend FRC Action's Values Voter Summit at no cost. At VVS, students will join thousands of like-minded conservatives who care about the issues that are shaping our nation. They'll enjoy our student mixer trivia night, topics covering everything from history to politics to the upcoming 2020 election. They'll hear from key conservatives, including Ali Stuckey, Congressman Mark Meadows, Dana Lash, and more. They'll have the opportunity to pursue influential jobs and internships with reputable organizations at our job fair meet and greet. Students will also have the chance to learn how to impact our world by attending our student breakout sessions. From October 11th to 13th, come to Washington, D.C. for Values Voter Summit. This is one weekend no student should miss. Learn more about scholarships by visiting valuesvotersummit.org/students or by calling 1-877-372-2808.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. The website, TonyPerkins.com. Let me remind you, coming up just around the corner, the Values Voter Summit. Pray, vote, stand. Find out more how you can be a part of this exciting event, a gathering of social conservatives from across the country. Go to TonyPerkins.com. There's still room, but you're going to have to move quickly. So go to TonyPerkins.com and register today for the Values Voter Summit coming up October the 11th through the 13th right here in Washington, D.C. All right, as Nancy Pelosi has chosen to lead the nation down this path of impeachment, or at least attempting to, I thought it might be helpful to talk to a legal expert on the impeachment process. So joining me now is John Malcolm. He is the Vice President for Constitutional Government at the Heritage Foundation, who also serves as Chairman of the Criminal Law Practice Group of the Federalist Society. Before joining the Heritage Association, in 2012, he was the general counsel at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, as well as a distinguished practitioner in residence at Pepperdine Law School. He's a graduate of law, Harvard Law School, and holds a bachelor's degree in economics from Columbia College. John, welcome to Washington Watch.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, let's just start with the basics. I mean, the average American isn't an expert on impeachment. Only two presidents have been impeached by the House, Andrew Johnson in 1868, Bill Clinton in 1999, but neither man lost his job. The authority of the Congress under Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution says the House of Representatives has the sole power of impeachment. Only the House can pass a resolution of impeachment alleging that a president has committed treason, bribery, or high crimes and misdemeanors. So first of all, what would qualify as a high crime or misdemeanor? And under what category would they be pursuing this president for impeachment?
Well, so the first significant thing is actually the language you said where the House has the sole power to return articles of impeachment. There is no judge that is involved in that process. It is largely left to the members of Congress and the Senate to decide what constitutes a high crime and misdemeanor. So treason people understand, bribery people understand. High crimes and misdemeanors has generally been perceived to be considered either just outright crookedness, felonious conduct, or a gross abuse of power. So we have elections essentially to decide policy differences. Impeachment is a radical measure that is designed to immediately remove somebody from office because they're just a bad person whom we don't want to be serving for 4 years.
Now, I mentioned only twice have presidents been impeached. As you
said,
it's kind of a radical move. We've had judges that have been impeached, a handful. We've had a senator impeached. But the issue here is the high hurdle, because the House is just the first stop. The secondary process of this is it goes over to the Senate. Explain that to our listeners.
Sure. So actually, you've made a good distinction. People often get confused and they think that when somebody is impeached, that means that they are removed from office. That is not true. An impeachment is the equivalent of an indictment. It's a leveling of charges. The House of Representatives does that, and they only do it by a majority vote. So the fact of the matter is that you have a majority of Democrats in the House, and if they stick together and decide that they want to impeach President Trump, there's precious little that can be done to stop them. There would be a referral to the House Judiciary Committee. They would draft up articles of impeachment. They would vote on those articles of impeachment, refer them to the whole House, and if the majority of the House approves of those articles, it then moves on to the Senate for a trial. There, it is a little tougher. Members of the House of Representatives are called impeachment managers. They are the prosecutors, if you will. The Senate establishes its own procedures. It can be a full-blown trial, or it can be a truncated trial, as happened with the Clinton impeachment proceeding. And it takes two-thirds of the Senate, so 67 senators, to remove the president. So, for instance, during the Clinton impeachment proceedings, there were actually one or two articles of impeachment where a majority of the senators said, yes, I think he did it and ought to be removed, but they fell well short of the 67 Senate vote margin that they needed to actually throw him out of the office. The only involvement that the judiciary has in any of this at any point is that the Constitution says that if there is a trial in the Senate for the president, that the Chief Justice of the United States shall preside over that trial. So William Rehnquist was the person who was in the well of the Senate presiding over the trial of President Clinton.
Well, John, that raises the question here. A two-thirds majority in the Senate, that would mean you would have to have 67 votes, as you pointed out. Currently, Democrats have 47 seats. That would mean that 20 Republican senators would have to vote to confirm this in impeachment. I mean, that's a
right.
You would have to think that the evidence would have to be overwhelming, and it just doesn't suggest that they could be anywhere close to that. In fact, I think it's significant. I was just talking with Kevin McCarthy earlier that Nancy Pelosi, this is the first time in modern time that they have proceeded with an investigation without a vote of the House.
Yeah, so that's not established in the Constitution. That is a House rule. So you're right. The normal process is that the entire House would vote to begin an impeachment inquiry. And Nancy Pelosi has chosen not to do this at the moment, probably because either she thinks she doesn't have the votes or she doesn't want her colleagues on record, at least at this point, until there's further factual development. She has instead called on the six committee chairs and said, look, all of you are investigating some aspect of this president. You know, there's no end to these investigations. And we're going to have a more coordinated, we're going to proceed in a more coordinated fashion and eventually decide whether or not to actually draft articles of impeachment, which, of course, as I said, would be done by the House Judiciary Committee. So nothing about this process is regular, but there is no constitutional requirement that the full House take a vote before they start down this road.
John, we're up against a break, but one quick final question. Time frame, how long does it take for this to play out?
Oh, it could take up to and through the election. There is no time limit on this.
So this could become just an election issue, or that could be the reason they're pursuing it at this time, to make an election issue.
Both of those observations are exactly correct.
All right. John Malcolm, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your insight into this.
Great issue. To be with you.
All right. Find out more, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. All right. When I come back, when we all come back, today on Capitol Hill, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom held a hearing on the status of religious freedom in Iraq. Are we making progress? We'll talk about that next with one of my fellow commissioners, Nadine Manza. That's next.
Radical abortion laws in New York, Illinois, and Vermont are challenging the sanctity of life. These laws have lifted the few existing restrictions on abortion in the name of family planning and mental health of pregnant mothers. Americans need to take a stand and defend the rights of the unborn. Family Research Council is sending Congress 90,000 baby hats as a reminder that babies should be welcomed with love and warmth, not potential danger. Supporters have already funded over 45,000 hats. We are over halfway there. Join Americans across the nation and donate $9 to send a powerful reminder that young lives need to be cherished. When you take action, we'll send you an end birthday abortion certificate that will remind you to pray for born alive babies who are facing the danger of being killed outside the womb. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com for more information. That's endbirthdayabortion.com.
Are you concerned with the state of our nation? Do you want to protect and promote religious freedom, the sanctity of life, free speech, and our children's educations? Today we see a growing threat against our values on the news, on our college campuses, in our elementary schools, at our public libraries, and in our courts. Every year in Washington, D.C., thousands of conservatives attend FRC Action's Values Voters Summit. From October 11th to the 13th, come to our nation's capital to mingle with and hear from key conservatives who are bringing real change to Washington, D.C., and learn how you can too. FRC President Tony Perkins will be there, along with Ali Stuckey, Bill Bennett, Dana Lash, Oliver North, and U.S. House and Senate leaders. The 2020 elections are right around the corner, so this is one weekend you won't want to miss. We provide free scholarships for students. Register online at valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808. That's 1-877-372-2808.
This is Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us on this Thursday afternoon. The website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, as I mentioned earlier today, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, in accordance with their statutory authority, held a hearing on Capitol Hill about religious freedom and the situation in Iraq as it pertains to religious minorities. Now, one of the witnesses was Peri Ibrahim. She is the founder and executive director of the Free Yazidi Foundation. Now, here's a short clip of her testimony from earlier today.
Just over 5 years ago, ISIS terrorists began the genocidal campaign against the Yazidi community. This was a well-planned and carefully targeted attack against the Yazidi community aimed to eradicate the Yazidis, not for territory or wealth, but just simply to destroy our people because of our religion.
Now, since that time, the United States has been there with USAID, rebuilding communities after our military drove ISIS out. The question is, are we making progress in Iraq? Are these religious minorities returning to their communities, providing stability to Iraq through diversity? That was the question we were pursuing today at the hearing. And joining me now to talk about this is one of my fellow commissioners who recently made a trip to Iraq, Nadine Manza. She is the vice chair of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Nadine, welcome to Washington Watch.
Appreciate it.
Now, let me just start with your observations. You were in Iraq about a month ago. Last month you were there.
Right.
I missed my flight, so I wasn't there with you. But the situation there, there are problems. We heard that today. You saw it. Explain to our listeners what's happening.
Right. So, you know, that while the USAID and Samaritan's Purse and Heartland Alliance, there are just so many great groups on the ground doing amazing work rebuilding homes. I was encouraged by a lot of the development I saw that was happening that's real. The problem at the end of the day seems to be it's really just not safe for these minorities to return home, for Christians, for Yazidis. I think only 10% of the Yazidis have been able to return. It's almost as if nothing has changed for them since really ISIS attacked them. And so, you know, what we've learned from the hearing today and what we learned when we were on our trip in Iraq was that these Iraqi government-sponsored militias That are aligned with Iran really do control so much of the land in the Nineveh Plains. And we heard today during the hearing that some villages even have pictures of the Ayatollah as you drive into the village. Imagine being a Christian trying to return to your home and having to drive through that and knowing that those are the people that are, quote, protecting you.
Well, this is the cradle of Christianity. Some of Jesus' own disciples took the gospel here, and you've had Christians there in the Nineveh Plains. I mean, this area plays so significantly in Christian history and in Jewish history.
It does.
In fact, a century ago, a third of Babylon, or a third of Baghdad, rather, was Jewish. People.
It's amazing to hear the beautiful history of this country and how people lived together for ages in peace, and yet the last several decades have been just horrible for people and horrible particularly for Christians.
Well, you speak of Christians about prior to ISIS coming in, and you had 1.5 million Christians. Today, it's less than 200,000. The United States is doing all that it can. We heard great testimony about what the NGOs, non-governmental organizations like Samaritan's Purse, Heartland, and others, Catholic Charities, so many of them, doing great work rebuilding, building houses, infrastructure. You've got the minority communities themselves committed to hardships to stay there. The problem seems to be with the Iraqi government and not reining in these militias, which they control and pay.
Right. When we were in Iraq, we were actually there the week that the prime minister had given an order that all the militias were to come underneath the Iraqi security forces. And they were to come in by the end of July. We were there during that time, and they didn't all come under. And in fact, one of, I believe, the 50th and the 30th that have both been tagged as being terrorists by the United States government, and both their leaders have sanctions, they announced that they didn't have to come under the Iraqi government, and then they ended up showing up with tanks. And I was told by some people on the ground that between 40 families ended up fleeing because they didn't feel safe. So we're still seeing all sorts of problems with security there.
So what are the top three issues that these minority communities are saying are keeping them from going back to their communities?
Well, number one would be security for sure. But of course, houses, they're not all – some people don't have a place to stay. The economic situation is still pretty – iffy for a lot of folks that aren't able to make a living. But those things are all workable. The problem really is security at this point.
And all of those relate to security, because if you don't have security, you can't have economic development. And as I understand, there are private international community, the international community through private funding, is ready to do some investments in Iraq to make their economy sustainable. But the security is in the way.
Exactly. So all the pieces are there. I mean, when you looked a couple years ago, they weren't all there, but they're there. You just have that one piece left.
So this falls upon the leadership of the Iraqi government.
It does.
Nadine Manza, thank you so much for coming over to FRC and joining me today.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right. Where are you going to next?
We'll let you know.
Okay. All right. Keep me in suspense. All right, folks, well, I'll tell you where I'm going next, right here. I'm not going anywhere. When I come back, we're going to be talking about 80% of the world's population, according to the president, facing some type of religious persecution. The media's taking him to task for that. Travis Weber joins me next to talk about it. Don't go away. Hello, this is Tony Perkins, President of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C. I want to invite you to join Luana and myself, along with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, for FRC's Israel Tour, June the 2nd through June the 12th, 2020. Whether you're sailing on the Sea of Galilee, standing in the ruins of Capernaum, or journeying up to Jerusalem, Israel is unlike any other place on earth. You'll relive the final earthly days of Jesus as you pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. You look upon Golgotha and stand in the Garden Tomb. The reality of his story will come alive in a transformative way. This one-of-a-kind tour will not only allow you to explore the land of the Bible and the roots of our Christian faith, you'll also hear firsthand from some of Israel's political, defense, and religious leaders. Join us June the 2nd through June the 12th for this life-changing experience. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
Planned Parenthood is not pro-woman. For decades, the nation's leading abortion supplier has claimed to be the champion of women's rights, but nothing could be farther from the truth. Planned Parenthood has repeatedly violated the law and violated women, from aiding and abetting sex traffickers, covering up child sexual abuse, and selling the remains of aborted baby parts, to ignoring the devastating effects that abortion has on women's physical and mental health. From its racist eugenic roots to the targeting of vulnerable communities, Planned Parenthood is an organization that not only promotes a culture of death, but makes it a reality. In a new brochure from FRC, you will find evidence that will challenge your assumptions about Planned Parenthood and equip you with the information you need to be a true champion for women and the lives of unborn children. To order this brochure and to download your free digital copy, visit frc.org/Planned Parenthood.
It's almost that time of year. FRC Action's annual Values Voter Summit is just around the corner, but there is still time to register. Join thousands of like-minded conservatives who, just like you, care about the state of our nation and want to do their part in protecting and promoting religious freedom and the sanctity of life, free speech, and marriage and the family. From October 11th through the 13th, come to Washington, D.C. to attend FRC Action's Values Voter Summit and hear from key conservatives who will bring real change to Washington. And learn how you can, too. FRC Action President Tony Perkins will be there, along with Ali Stuckey, Bill Bennett, Dana Lash, Oliver North, and Congressman Mark Meadows. The 2020 elections are fast approaching, so this is one weekend you won't want to miss. Ask about our scholarship for students. Register online at valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808. That's 1-877-372-2808.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. The website is TonyPerkins.com. Let me remind you, Values Voter Summit coming up October the 11th through the 13th, the premier gathering for social conservatives. I invite you to join us. Go to TonyPerkins.com and register now. All right, talking about religious freedom, and by the way, the situation in Iraq. You know, we've made such an investment in terms of time and resources as a country there and have done everything, quite frankly, well. The issue now is the government of Iraq. And I'm hopeful that that the president, of course, you know, so many issues pounding him. But I've seen him do this, like with Turkey, with Andrew Brunson, where he put pressure upon them and they released him. I saw yesterday, and I'll mention a little bit later more about my trip to the border, but I've seen the effect of his negotiations with Mexico over trade and protecting the border and assisting in the immigration problem, that it's working. So I'm hopeful that he'll take a tough approach with Saudi Arabia, with Iraq, as it pertains to the religious minorities there. All right, on Monday, as we talked about, President Trump made a historic speech at the United Nations, first time ever that a president of the United States drew the world's attention to religious freedom. Now, I was there, and in his remarks, here is something he said. He talked about the large percentage of people around the world who are being oppressed or repressed because of their faith. Here's a clip of what he had to say.
Approximately 80% of the world's population live in countries where religious liberty is threatened, restricted, or even banned. And when I heard that number, I said, please go back and check it because it can't possibly be correct. And sadly, it was 80%.
Well, John Greenberg at PolitiFact.com took issue with that statistic in a column published yesterday entitled Donald Trump's Flawed Stat on Threats to religious freedom. Well, joining me now in studio to talk about that is Travis Weber, FRC's director of our Center for Religious Freedom and our vice president of public policy. All right, Travis, is it a flawed statistic?
It's not a flawed statistic, Tony. You know, and this comes down to this. PolitiFact has an issue because President Trump is saying it. The stat is a Pew Research stat. It's been repeated by other entities, other outlets. It's been around for a while. And they've decided to fact check it and erroneously conclude that it's a half-true statement in a rather shoddy piece of so-called fact checking. I think really this comes down to the fact that President Trump is the one who made the statement. They don't like that, so they're going to fact check it and try to twist it. But as you know, we can look into this and talk about it. But basically, the stat is a verifiable stat about countries with restrictions at significant levels, religious restrictions around the world, and that is an accurate number of the world's population that faces these problems.
And it's to differing degrees. So it's not like when he says 80%, not all of them are being treated as they are in China, maybe being put into concentration camps like the Uyghurs, or in North Korea, killed if they're found out to be Christian. So it's the varying degrees of discrimination, repression, persecution, prosecution.
Right. So, and President Trump said, 80% of the world's population lives where religious liberty is in significant danger or even completely outlawed. So there is some range even within his statement of the severity of the restriction. The Pew data and Pew survey point this out, noting variation in the level of restriction and the source, social hostility or governmental restriction. The point to the Pew stat and the point to President Trump's use of that stat is that the widespread nature, the severity of the restriction and the restriction itself is very widespread. So he's making a broad claim, and PolitiFact basically, I think is rather misleading by titling this a flawed stat, as the PolitiFact article itself goes through the issue. It cites a few outside sources, he consulted so-called experts who don't really dispute this. They just acknowledge there's range within that right. Severity, as we've just talked about. And then PolitiFact basically concludes that there's a problem with this because the president didn't point this out. Well, it's you can use the stat, and I don't – it just really doesn't make much sense to be going after Pew like this. I don't understand it. I'm happy to talk about religious freedom, though.
Well, Greenberg at PolitiFact.com writes that while the math is correct and supports Trump's claim, we should take a closer look at the Pew study. The Pew Research Center's most recent survey of religious restrictions showed two types of problems, government actions and actions by individuals or groups, which it calls social hostility. Now, even at USERF, where we look at religious freedom and hostility to that freedom, it's acknowledged that, A, sometimes government is the perpetrator of the persecution, and that there are other times when, B, it's non-government actors, but government still has a responsibility to protect government from the non-government actors.
Government absolutely has that responsibility. An example of this, the case of Asia Bibi in Pakistan. In Pakistan, the legal and constitutional protections are actually somewhat decent for religious freedom, at least compared to the social hostility, which is off the charts. And as we saw last year, Asia Bibi was exonerated by the country's high court, but she had to be kept in secret locations, protected because of mobs who wanted her to be killed despite the fact that she was exonerated. So that's the kind of social hostility where if the government doesn't step in, you've got serious problems. Meanwhile, in China and North Korea, the hostility is being perpetrated by the government itself, credible restrictions. All of this is bad news, and I'm glad it's bad news to see this around the world. Glad the president highlighted this. And, it's something that we should talk about more.
I mean, ultimately, does it matter if you are being dragged out of your house and put in prison for your faith, or you have a government that stands and turns a blind eye while someone comes in and blows up your church or your synagogue, or someone storms into a mosque and shoots people while the government watches? The end result is the same. People of faith are repressed, persecuted, and in the effort is to drive them from their faith.
Yeah, I don't think it matters much. These people who are facing a violence or their lives are at risk, I don't think it matters much to them whether it's an official government actor or not. I mean, we saw at the hearing, the USERF hearing today on the Hill, you know, these folks in Iraq facing issues at the hands of security threats, facing issues at the hands of forces and security threats, which are not necessarily formally aligned with the government in the same way as others, but it's still a religious freedom problem.
It's just amazing to me that they're going to take issue not with the with the president because he used a stat from the Pew Research and over religious freedom. It to me, I go back to something I said earlier in the program about the impeachment, is that they're looking for anything and everything to stop the advancement that this president is making. And religious freedom is at the top of the list of the advancements that this administration is accomplishing.
Tony, it is. And the funny thing about this PolitiFact so-called fact-checking article, it references the use of that stat in the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation. Well, if you go to that link, they reference a Pew study from several years ago. But then the PolitiFact links to the more recent Pew study and uses that as its basis for supposedly debunking the religious freedom of business and President Trump's use of that stat. It's not even logically connected. And you can find maps where you have 80% of the world's population under these restrictions. Christianity Today has used them. Other news outlets have used them. Where are the PolitiFact so-called fact checkers when those outlets using them? We only have this occurring. President
because
Trump
the president uses
it. Right.
It is mind-blowing.
But we can talk
about the level of opposition.
We're glad to talk about this issue because it's not getting enough attention and it needs to be.
Yeah, I guess roundabout way, because of the media wants to challenge the president's statistics on international religious persecution, that we get to talk about it more because they challenge his statistics.
Right. It gives us an opportunity to talk about an issue that needs to be talked about. Tony, Fox News has used this stat. The Potomac Declaration that came out of last year's ministerial has used this stat.
I used it Monday morning on Fox News.
I used it in materials. There have been other op-eds. I mean, everyone's been using it. Where are the fact checkers then? I mean, because it doesn't need to be fact checked.
That's the president.
Right.
Well, speaking of that, Travis, yesterday, as you know, I was down on the border in El Paso, and I would have to say this, and this may come as a surprise. I was actually surprised at how the media twisted the coverage of the immigration crisis on the border. Even I was shocked to the level of, well, I guess to use the term, fake news. I mean, this is what – it's fascinating. It was a very educational trip as I went down there on the border. Standing there on the border. In fact, while I was there, two people came across and picked up by the Border Patrol. They're coming across actually turning themselves in. They're not trying to sneak across. They're trying to get asylum into the country. But here's what's happened, right? And this is very concise version of this. Back in March and April when we had this surge of people. And I'm just talking about this one sector. This is replicated across the other sectors of the South. This is the El Paso sector. On average, they will get maybe 100 people coming across the border a day. A busy day would be 200. During that surge in April and March and April and May, they were having 7,500 come across. Far more than they've ever had before. Part of it was because of the policy that, you know, we had this vacillation on the policy, the president trying to change the policy. They were afraid it was going to change, so people started heading for the border. I mean, what politicians say and do and what's reported in the media has an effect on people's behavior. So there's this surge across the border. We don't have the capacity to deal with them. They were having to, you know, try to warehouse, you know, to take people, hold them long enough to process them, to release them. And, of course, the media comes down there in the midst of this chaos and takes a picture and says, this is how we deal with immigration. Well, it's a snapshot of the midst of a crisis.
And one picture is not a policy.
No. So they quickly began building temporary facilities to house people, putting so many resources into it. 60% of the Border Patrol down there is actually now just processing and working with the people that come across. Only 40% are actually guarding the border, and keeping drugs from coming through and criminals who want to do harm to this country. And so they're now, they've got a long-term plan. They're building permanent structures. But here's where the president's negotiations come in, and how if this president were not hampered at every turn by the the liberals in Congress, by negotiating over the trade with Mexico, playing hardball with them and getting them to agree to protect the border, they've done a couple of things. They now, these individuals who come across wanting asylum, they are processed within about a 24-hour period. They're given a court date where they can come in and get a hearing. But in the meantime, they go back to Mexico. If they speak Spanish and they can dwell there, live there, they are sent back. And so they're now just in El Paso, in that sector, 18,000 people who have come across the border are now over in Mexico. And Mexico's having to deal with that situation. Where I was standing, I saw the Mexican military standing there at the border trying to, deter people from coming across. So now they have a manageable, back to maybe 100 people a day coming through. I was there as they were processing, they're showing the food that they give them, the clothing, taking care of them, toys and everything for the kids to play with. And nothing like what the media portrayed this to be. And it's working right now. The process is working because the president played hardball, negotiated an outcome. However, here's the concern, is that if Mexico doesn't continue to uphold this, we get back to where we have all these people coming across the border.
Yeah.
But we also met with those who are dealing with the separation, or dealing with the families that have left their homes, and we heard about the separations. And again, that was short term. They've worked to solve that problem as well. But you have to realize they were in the midst of a crisis, and that was just a short period of time in which the media kind of took this picture and portrayed this as our immigration policy, which it was not. Now, there is a lot of burden on the churches, especially now over in Mexico, that are trying to house these families and these individuals. So there's a need. There's a great humanitarian need there on the border that Mexico right now is picking up the bulk of. And really, this is the way the private community, the way churches here in the United States can help in a tangible way while upholding the law, but still help these families who are in need.
Yep, Tony. I know Franklin Graham's organization, Samaritan's Purse, is down there. Really hearing you talk about this, it really sounds like there's no substitute for going somewhere and seeing it with our own eyes. If we're getting our information from somewhere, we need to ensure it's an accurate source, because in this day and age, it's not all accurate. And things are spun, they're misreported, intentionally sometimes, negligently in others. And then we go off with right. half-cocked solutions.
And unfortunately used for political advantage.
Yeah.
And that affects people's lives.
It does.
Travis, out of time. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Hey, and folks, thank you for joining us. Until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul, found in Ephesians 6, where he says, "When you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, prepared, and taken your stand, by all means, keep standing."
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.